empty space.
Scenes from a Border Patrol facility near the San Diego-Mexico border yesterday as federal police arrested half a dozen protesters. Some of them were doctors, the protesters, demanding to be allowed to give migrants flu shots after several children in custody died from flu-related illnesses this year. Meantime, the Trump administration has started sending some migrant families seeking asylum all the way to Guatemala, even if they're not from there. Molly O'Toole covers immigration and national security for the LA Times. Hi there.
Hi.
Well, so before we get into your story about the Guatemala migrants or the migrants being sent to Guatemala, first, tell us about this flu shot story. The government is refusing to give flu shots to migrants?
Well, there had been recommendations, among other things, that the Homeland Security Department and Customs and Border Protection in particular provide flu shots to migrants in their custody, in particular following a spate of deaths that have been believed to have been related to the flu. And since CBP did not accept that recommendation, there have been several deaths of migrants from the flu. CBP, the agency that's part of Homeland Security, says that administering vaccines such as the flu shot has never been CBP policy, but in part because CBP is supposed to be temporarily holding migrants. They're not supposed to keep them longer than a very short period of time before essentially handing them off to other agencies that do longer-term detention or, you know, potentially releasing them depending on what the circumstances. And so they say that if they were to start administering flu shots, that would keep people in their care longer than they're supposed to be. That has been the response so far, but CBP has also admitted and engaged in a really comprehensive review of its medical screening of migrants, of the medical resources that are provided, of healthcare professionals that they contract to work with them, because there really have been a spate of what apparently have seemed to be potentially preventable deaths in their custody under the Trump administration.
Wow. Okay. So meanwhile, the Trump administration is sending people seeking asylum to Guatemala, even though they're not from there. Why are they doing that?
So it's part of what is a relatively new agreement that has been signed with Guatemala, in which Guatemala agreed to take non-Guatemalan asylum seekers. It's not specific, but it's believed to be primarily targeting other Central Americans, so Salvadorans, Hondurans, who come to the U.S.-Mexico border to seek asylum. Instead, they're being removed to Guatemala. And that agreement was signed in July, but it didn't start to be implemented until just a few weeks ago, November 22nd. And initially, officials had said that it would be fairly limited. It was just a pilot program. It was only going to apply to single adults. But what the LA Times has found is starting yesterday, several families received notices that they would be removed to Guatemala as well.
And so if they are from El Salvador or Honduras, they're not being sent all the way to those countries.
No, under this circumstance, under this agreement, they would be sent essentially to an earlier step in the typical path that people might take from the Northern Triangle to the U.S.-Mexico border. They'd be sent directly south of Mexico to Guatemala. And it should be seen as, you know, this is part of the Trump administration's effort to effectively end asylum at the southern border by requiring people to seek protection elsewhere, and not just in Mexico, but even further south now to Guatemala. And they have similar agreements with El Salvador and Honduras, but those agreements have yet to be implemented. So this is the first one that's begun to be implemented.
So would these migrants who are from these other countries then apply for asylum in Guatemala or apply for asylum in America in Guatemala?
So ostensibly, the way this policy has been designed and described is that they would seek asylum in Guatemala instead. Uh-huh. And it has also been described, this agreement, as something akin to a safe third country agreement, such as the U.S. has with Canada. And of course, critics will point out that Canada and Guatemala have vastly different resources, vastly different countries. Guatemala basically has a virtually non-existent asylum system. At one point, it was reported that they only had 11 asylum officers for the entire country. And it should also be noted that Guatemala itself sends a lot of asylum seekers and migrants to the U.S.-Mexico border because Guatemala has its own struggles for a long time with corruption, mm-hmm. with inequality, with poverty, with violence, now some of the impacts of climate change. So critics will point out this is not exactly a safe third country agreement because Guatemala is not exactly a safe country to be sending people to encourage them to seek asylum there instead of in the United States.
And what about legally? Are there any legal questions surrounding this? Did Guatemala agree to this, or is the U.S. just doing it?
Well, there are a lot of legal questions, in part for those reasons that I just described. Under a typical safe third country agreement, and the requirements of those are laid out in the law, the Secretary of Homeland Security and also the Department of Justice would essentially have to certify that the country does have a process, does have a system in place for processing, you know, claims of those who are seeking protection, to essentially ensure that you aren't, you know, sending someone back or sending someone to a country where they will be put in harm's way. But what's unique about the Safe Third Country Agreements, and the administration kind of goes back and forth describing the Guatemala Agreement as a Safe Third Country Agreement or not as a Safe Third Country Agreement, what's unique about them as well is while you do have to certify that the country does have some sort of system in place to fairly and safely process people and accept them, they're pretty much outside of judicial review. Mm-hmm. They're considered within the sort of foreign policy purview of the executive. So there are legal questions, certainly. But with these agreements with the Northern Triangle in particular, in many respects, they're believed to be sort of outside judicial review. And so in many ways, this is something that the Trump administration is just pursuing. Now, initially, Guatemala's highest court said that their outgoing president couldn't enter into this agreement on his own, that he needed, you know, the agreement of lawmakers within Guatemala. But it has since been allowed to go forward and begin to be implemented.
Right. And so meanwhile, there are also people from other countries, not even on this continent, who are seeking asylum at our southern border, people from Africa, people from the Middle East. Are they also going to be sent to Guatemala?
So now, ostensibly under this agreement, and a lot of details about these agreements are sort of out there, and we know from the way that they've been implemented, sort of haphazardly, even the asylum officers who are implementing these agreements aren't quite clear on what they mean. This is just a perfect example. Initially, they said, you know, this is a pilot, it's only going to be applied to single adults, and then sort of without even an announcement, they started issuing notices to families yesterday. So clearly, there are a lot of things that are nebulous about this, but as far as we understand it, and looking at sort of the preliminary language that we have that's been publicized so far about the agreement, it does not rule out asylum seekers who are other than Central Americans, such mm-hmm. as the African populations that you referred to, of which there's been a growing number. It also doesn't rule out migrants who didn't pass through Guatemala. For example, perhaps a Honduran who flew to Mexico City and then walked to the border from there. So transit is not necessarily a requirement, or even being from the region is not necessarily a requirement under these agreements. So they could be very broad and sweeping. The real limiting factor probably will most likely be just what Guatemala is capable of taking.
Molly O'Toole covers immigration and national security for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks.
Thanks.
One of the key players to put Trump's border policies into effect, the consulting giant McKinsey and Company. The famously secretive firm was put on the government payroll during the Obama administration, originally to help restructure ICE. But documents obtained by ProPublica found McKinsey's role pivoted under Trump to streamlining and cheapening immigration detention. McKinsey consultants proposed slashing spending on food and medical care for migrants and cutting security supervision, among other things. McKinsey's controversies, though, not just tied to its work for the United States government. Its client list has included opioid makers like Purdue Pharma, Saudi Arabia's monarchy, and Enron, the infamous energy company brought down by a massive fraud scandal. It's also played a role in a huge political corruption scandal in South Africa. McKinsey's less-than-stellar reputation is now seeping into the 2020 election. Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg worked there for a time, and he released his client list yesterday after receiving some pressure from voters. Joining me to talk about this is Ian McDougall. He wrote about McKinsey for ProPublica. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right. First of all, this is a 90-plus-year-old company, and what does it do?
It historically has been a company that helps originally really sort of companies more in the realm of manufacturing, do things like, you know, streamline supply chains or cut costs. And that's still a very, very large part of the work that they do. Starting in the 90s, the firm really shifted its strategy to fairly rapid growth. And as part of that process, it is moved into a lot of other areas of work, including to a much greater degree than it had before, the sort of public sector, government agencies, government-owned companies, that kind of thing.
Right. So it no longer works for ICE, right?
No, that ICE decided to end that contract in the summer of 2018.
But this was after scandals broke about what it did. Can you go into a little bit more detail?
About the ICE?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So essentially, as you said, that began under the Obama administration, and McKinsey maintains nothing changed when the Trump administration came in, though I think that's an effort to be cute, although I'd call it misleading on their part. Really what happened is they had under Obama sort of two streams they were working on at the very end of the administration. One was reducing procurement costs. The other was sort of hiring in a general sense. In late January, the president signed two executive orders, which were meant to kick off a crackdown on illegal immigration. As part of those orders, the president had directed ICE to hire 10,000 new immigration officers, which is an enormous undertaking for an agency of its size, and then also to move more resources towards detention centers near the border, anticipating an influx of detainees. And so McKinsey's work very quickly shifted to, on the hiring front, helping figure out how to hire those 10,000 new immigration officers, what kind of timeline, whether it accounted for attrition, all that sort of stuff. And then on the procurement side, trying to figure out how to reduce spending on detention centers, given that they were expecting to have a lot more, need a lot more beds.
Right. So that would mean like cutting money for food and medicine too, right?
That was one of the things they suggested early on. They ended up being involved in renegotiating five detention center contracts, and I'm told that ultimately some of the suggestions like that ICE officials, some of them found troubling, didn't end up in those contracts. However, ICE says that those cost analyses that McKinsey did remain on the books, so they could influence future contract negotiations.
Aside from suggesting that the Trump administration hire 10,000 more officers, was the company involved in any more policies, in designing policies, or were they just involved in suggesting budget cuts?
They make a distinction between policy and execution. They say they don't do policy, as some of their own consultants raised during the ICE engagement. You know, execution can kind of bleed into policy. It's not a very clear line sometimes. So they weren't proposing specific immigration policies, but the way in which you carry out those kinds of directives can start to look a little bit like policy. They also had worked for right after the ICE contract ended. They worked for Customs and Border Protection, which oversees Border Patrol and other agencies. And that work was helping them put together a strategy document to replace the Obama era one. And so there they were helping documents that we've obtained show they were helping the CBP, you know, figure out which initiatives to include in their strategy guide. And that included looking at things like the president's border wall, which comes up in some of McKinsey's documents, and also things like working with other agencies to deter migration to the U.S., which is, generally speaking, code for criminal prosecution.
So that would be under the Justice Department?
Yes.
So what did McKinsey say about the wall? Did they say whether or not that would be a good idea?
They weren't saying whether it was a good idea or not. They were suggesting what of a number of initiatives to prioritize for the strategy document.
So they were involved in policy.
You could say that. I mean, they would say they weren't, but you know, I think it's a matter of how you define policy, how broadly or narrowly you draw it.
So McKinsey also consulted for Rikers, which is being shut down in New York, and pretty infamous lockup there. They were paid $27 million or so to help curb some of the violence in that prison. Violence, though, increased since they were hired. So what did they put into place that didn't really work?
So they began by just assessing sort of the causes of violence there and coming up with proposals to reform the jail. But from the start, there were issues. When they put that together, they didn't, they really just spoke to corrections officials. They didn't talk to inmates. They didn't talk to clinic staff or others with knowledge of sort of drivers of violence there, even though they were told that they should. And from there, they proposed a number of reforms. But the sort of emphasis of their work took sort of unusual turns, I suppose, that were probably more helpful to McKinsey than to the Department of Correction. For example, they were very eager to develop these advanced data analytics tools, which in a place like Rikers, which really, I mean, there aren't computers in a lot of the jails, just weren't really, they weren't practical. What they were helpful for is presenting to other corrections departments to say, look at this thing we've made, we can make that for you too. They were trying to expand into that sector of consulting. Mm.
So given that they have expanded into working for governments and public entities, they work for many governments overseas. They've worked for South Africa, very controversial program there, where the head of McKinsey had to eventually apologize to South Africa for working with people who looted the country. They've worked with the Saudis. They've worked with China. Why is this private company being asked to increasingly take on governmental roles?
A lot of it, there are two, I guess, categories. One is there is a realm of government work that looks a lot like the private sector work that McKinsey's quite good at, so reorganizing an agency, something like that. But McKinsey in the private sector and in the public sector is used for other purposes. One of them is to make suggestions that might be unpopular and that, a policymaker or a agency head or a CEO doesn't want to, you know, make on his or her own, and so can say, you know, these very smart people came in, looked at the problem, and they said we should do this. So it's not, you know, you can't get mad at me, that's certainly plays a big role in why they're hired by government agencies.
And so, very quickly, we have a few seconds left. Looking at the work that Pete Buttigieg did, was he involved in any of these controversial programs?
His work, from what has come out, doesn't appear to be. There are some particularly controversial. There are some concerns that have been raised around some of the engagement. But when it comes down to it, the truth is he was, you know, essentially a worker bee at that point, and he wouldn't, as he said, and from my knowledge of McKinsey, it sounds correct. He's not making. He wasn't making big decisions. He was putting together the, you know, the data or the charts, things like that. Knowing as much as we know now, it doesn't seem that there's great cause for concern that he's involved in extremely controversial things. But we know a fairly limited amount about precisely the nature of the projects he was on.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Ian McDougall, contributing reporter at ProPublica. Coming up, why Santa Barbara and Ventura counties are heating up faster than the rest of the nation. That story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Santa Barbara is the birthplace of the modern environmental movement. Earth Day began there in 1970 after a disastrous oil spill. But since then, Santa Barbara has really not lived up to its green reputation. It has failed to cut CO2 emissions to meet California standards. Emissions there have actually increased. And it and neighboring Ventura County are experiencing some of the fastest rising temperatures in the nation. More than 4 degrees over the last century or so. Journalist Scott Wilson dug into this for a special investigation at the Washington Post, and he joins me now. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, this entire corridor from Santa Barbara down basically to the Mexican border is warming really, really fast. Why is that?
Scientists are trying to figure that out. There are a bunch of different reasons. Some have to do with the simple urbanization that's happened over the last century. We looked at 125 years of temperature data to come up with some of these numbers. But it was controlled somewhat for that. You know, the ocean's warming, and oceans usually absorb a lot of heat, so that's happening much less. Smog is increasing, so temperature inversions are happening more. That increases heat. And so those are some of the reasons, but really a lot of scientists don't have a single explanation for why this sweep of coastline is warming so much faster than the rest of the country.
So what are we seeing? What does it look like there in Santa Barbara, in Ventura? What's the weather like now?
Yeah. So the weather, you know, it's I quoted a guy in the story who called it global weirding rather than warming. And I think that kind of sums it up. It's don't only look at the warming. It's the extremes between the wet and the dry right after, the heat and the rain coming so close together in such extremes produces things like the Thomas Fire and the resulting landslides of a couple years ago that happened here and killed 23 people. You're seeing a erosion of coastline. The cliffs along UCSB are collapsing. Buildings are falling into the water. And you're seeing what's called managed retreat in Ventura County. The government spending money just to move simple city facilities back away from the rising coast. And you're seeing an increase in temperature that's forcing farmers throughout Santa Barbara and Ventura counties. Santa Barbara is obviously famous for its wine, different kinds of grapes being planted, different kinds of crops. Avocados take a lot of water, and they're not very resistant to big swings in temperature. So we're seeing agave, the plant that produces tequila, being grown along here now, coffee being grown along the South Coast. So, scientists are calling it sort of a tropicalization of the oceans. And then a real sort of dry onshore climate that's causing people to really start acting.
Right. And so, as you say, some are doing managed retreat from the coastline. Others are trying to adapt. The farmers are trying to adapt. But what about trying to reduce the causes of CO2 increases? What about reducing car pollution, for example?
Yeah. As you said in your introduction, Santa Barbara has talked a big game since that 1969 oil spill and yet hasn't really lived up to that reputation in a lot of ways. A lot of the environmentalists around here talk about the city and the county doing sort of just enough to kind of look good, but not enough that actually requires sacrifice from the public to really cut down on CO2 emissions. You said, getting people out of their cars. That's number one. And it's a complicated puzzle, and it will require sacrifice. But, that requires bringing jobs closer to where people live. So changing downtown Santa Barbara to have more residential housing in denser clusters. It's going to require Santa Barbara, which seems to think it has a God-given right to free parking, to get rid of free parking lots, which are the single biggest indicator of traffic on the roads. And these are things that the city just and the county just haven't been willing to do. let alone the fact that there's a proposal to more than triple a very large oil field in the north of the county, that the county supervisors are still deciding whether or not to approve, even as yesterday they passed a resolution declaring a climate emergency in the county. So there's a lot of mixed messages, and I don't think that there's a clear plan yet. And it does open the door for a lot of sort of climate doubters to say, you all talk a big game, but, you know, you're really not doing much. And even one county supervisor called Santa Barbara up with environmentalist poses, and he's an environmentalist. So, yeah. You know, it's going to require a lot more than the city's doing.
Well, let's go back to the oil field that you just mentioned, tripling the size of it, pretty rich, so to speak, given the fact that it was an oil spill that caused so much. Well, was the birth of the environmental movement, right? I mean, this massive oil spill basically galvanized the nation to take on environmentalism.
Yeah, I mean, it's this relationship that Santa Barbara and Ventura as well. Ventura's nickname is Bakersfield by the Sea, given how much oil it produces. I think it's the third highest oil producing county in the state. But Santa Barbara, you know, we have these, offshore oil derricks, some of which have been decommissioned, some of which may start up again soon under Trump administration easing of restrictions on them. And, you know, there's just a ton of oil in the Santa Barbara Channel. And to this day, it's, you know, leaking out of cracks in the ocean floor, some, you know, natural seepage that gives every beachgoer sort of tar on their feet. But it's big jobs and it's big money, and there's a big lobby. There was a proposition a couple years ago on the county ballot to stop fracking and other sort of high-risk oil exploration techniques, and the oil industry spent $7 million, which is a lot of money in a county this size, and defeated it. So, you know, there's a lot of just sort of big money politics and the constant threat of, you know, we're going to lose jobs if we cut back too quickly on our oil industry here. But expanding it seems to fly in the face of a lot of what the county government and the state government is talking about right now.
So, Scott, if a place like Santa Barbara, which likes to think of itself as green, doesn't have the political will or the power or the inclination to change its behaviors to meet environmental goals, I mean, what does that say about the rest of the country?
You know, it's, I think there's reason to be pessimistic, unfortunately, if a place like this can't do it. I mean, sometimes it takes, you know, it takes a wake up, for, people to really, you know, understand. But even in Santa Barbara, you know, there's still a debate. One of the supervisors I talked to just called climate change a hoax. And, you know, here we are in the cradle of the environmental movement. So, I think it's frustrating to a lot of environmental activists that science is being challenged continuously, and the unwillingness to even say, you know, look, we've got to build more, you know, in places that we haven't allowed building before, and might affect our aesthetics. Santa Barbara has a million architectural review boards, and yet it does, you know, has very little staff, really monitoring the environment. And so the priorities of a place like this and writ, you know, larger across the state and the country really have to change. And it's a lot of lip service so far and a lot of small incremental changes that make things a bit greener. But it's going to take a lot more to even reduce greenhouse gas emissions, because as you know, they're still going up here.
Well, Scott, thank you for your reporting. Really great story. I urge everyone to check it out at the Washington Post. Scott Wilson, senior national correspondent for the Post. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, an investigation into self-help guru Tony Robbins and allegations of sexual misconduct.
A lot of really vulnerable people are drawn to him because of what he preaches, because he says that he can help people transform their lives. And so the women told us that it was very difficult for them when they were allegedly treated this way.
All right. A sensitive story and some sensitive language coming up in it. A little warning there. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Tony Robbins has spent decades building a self-help empire, packing arenas full of people eager to hear the gospel he preaches.
You want to know what our biggest problem is in this room? I'll tell every one of you, if you're willing to hear me, what your biggest problem is. You think you shouldn't have them. Because problems are what make us grow. Problems are what sculpt our soul. Problems are what make us become more. If we can realize that life is always happening for us, not to us, game over. All the pain and suffering disappears.
Well, Robbins himself is now accused of causing some pain and suffering. At least 10 women, including several staffers, have accused him of either sexual harassment or of general mistreatment, including berating them during his seminars. The most serious allegation, Robbins may have sexually assaulted a minor who attended one of his seminars nearly 35 years ago. These allegations have been published in a series of stories by BuzzFeed. Reporter Katie Baker has been working on this series for more than a year, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, tell us about this allegation that he assaulted a minor at a summer camp here in Southern California. This was back in 1985?
Sure. Our latest investigation found that Tony Robbins has been accused of sexually assaulting a high schooler at a summer camp called Super Camp, then in Montecito, California, back in 1985. And my colleague Jane Bradley and I gathered accounts from the alleged victim herself and two former campers who said that they saw Robbins kissing a camper. And we also spoke with 9 others who heard about an incident firsthand and 30 more who heard about an incident secondhand at that time. We even obtained a diary entry that a camper wrote at the time. So it was a lot of corroboration for a story like this.
Did you talk to the girl herself, now woman?
We spoke with the alleged victim through her lawyers. She gave us an extremely detailed account of what she says happened to her that summer. Robbins has denied all allegations. He says that he didn't sexually assault anyone, but both he and the camp did acknowledge that there was an incident that they said was resolved and that wasn't sexual assault.
Right. So sexual assault, what are we talking about?
Mm-hmm. So the woman says that Robbins kissed and groped her, and we spoke with 2 former campers, both on the record in our story, who said that they saw Robbins kissing a camper that summer. We also spoke with former staffers who remember a camper telling them that Robbins kissed and groped her.
So Robbins' lawyers told us in a letter that these allegations are false, incomplete, fabricated. These are their words. And in a Medium post that he wrote, Robbins said this piece was riddled with falsehoods. So what is your response to their response?
Yeah, I mean, we welcome Mr. Robbins to address the allegations in our reporting specifically.
What are some of the other allegations that you've been reporting on?
Earlier this year, we published a series of investigations revealing how multiple former staffers and fans have accused Robbins of sexual misconduct over 3 decades. 10 women have said Robbins groped them, exposed himself, or sexually harassed them while they were at his seminars or working for him, and 9 of them said that they were upset by his actions. Other records we obtained showed that he had berated victims of rape and domestic violence, and once again, he's denied every allegation and accused us of lying.
And do you have corroboration? Do those 10 women have corroborating evidence or witnesses or anything like that? Or is it a he said, she said thing?
In stories like this, often what we do is talk to people who those women told their allegations to at the time. And of course, we did that in this case. So with every woman who came to us with a claim, we talked to people in their lives, whether it was a lawyer they consulted at the time or a family member, people like that, to corroborate what they told us.
So some of these women say that they were physically assaulted, right? They were groped or he exposed himself to them.
2 former fans said that Robbins touched their breasts while they were at his events, and one said he pulled her hand onto his crotch to feel his penis. Those women were on the record in one of our follow-up stories, and they say that those happened at public events. We also spoke with former staffers who said that he would get naked in front of them when they were working with him alone. Another said that he touched her leg during a job interview and that after every event around the world, her team would get phone calls from women complaining he had touched them inappropriately.
Okay, so I just want to play a clip of tape from a video that he posted in May where he addressed some of these allegations in your stories. And here is his response.
It's unfortunate, you know, that we live in this time in society where, you know, people who operate some of them businesses, yeah, they live for how to get your attention with the most salacious headlines, BuzzFeeds, and the business of feeding that, right? Because, you know, now the news comes to our pocket, and to get our attention, they got to do something crazy, right, to get your attention. They got to do something that sounds really intense to try to do it. But if you go past the headlines and you read the actual articles, you'll see the facts don't support what they talk about at all. And more importantly, if you do your homework, you'll see the people they're quoting are saying that they're misrepresenting and flat out lying to them.
So he's saying that you have misquoted your sources, that you've taken them out of context, that at least one woman has gone on the record to say that she didn't feel harassed by him at all.
So that woman in our story, we make it very clear that she did not feel like a victim and that she was not upset by what happened. She's on the record in our story, and it's very clear in the story that she was perfectly fine with him being naked in front of her while she was working alone with him. And one of the women that he berated after she talked about being abused by her husband also said that the experience was positive. But that's all in our story. And I think if people read our story, they'll see this is a complex story. Tony Robbins is the world's most famous self-help guru, and he has a lot of power. And I think it speaks to his power that some of these women do not see themselves as victims. But again, that's all in our story, and you can read that very clearly.
Well, let's talk about that one instance that you just mentioned about a woman who was berated in yeah. front of the audience.
Has he loved you? Has he looked out for you? Has he put up with you when you've been a crazy bitch? Have you ever been a crazy bitch? Ever?
This is kind of his, how he operates, right? He chooses someone in the audience to tell a story. She or he stands up, and then he kind of does an on-the-fly analysis in front of the audience. That's what happens at
exactly.
these seminars, right? So this woman gets up, and she tells a story that her husband had physically and emotionally abused her.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it's very complicated, but in this case, I ran the full transcript by half a dozen experts in domestic violence and sexual assault, and all of them were extremely troubled by the full transcript, and all of them said even if the woman herself, even if a alleged victim of domestic violence is okay with being berated in the way that he berated her, there are thousands of other people in that audience, and speaking like that just goes against everything that they try and do in their work. And again, such is the influence and power he holds over his followers that the woman in question thanked him and said it was useful. But according to the many experts we spoke with, you shouldn't accuse someone who says they're being abused by their husband of lying and call her a crazy, ask if she's been a crazy bitch. That type of language, they said, is extremely dangerous and inappropriate.
And so he defends this by saying, well, she actually thanked him and wrote a book about it and came out
the other
side.
That's all in our story.
Okay, yeah. So some of the women were, as you say, were okay with the harsh treatments, with his methods, even with being naked in front of them privately. But other women obviously were not. And so the women who were not okay with this, what did they say about the incidents and how it affected them?
I think it was really hard for a lot of the women we spoke to who really looked up to Tony Robbins, and whether they went to his seminars or they worked for him, they did so because they believed in him. And a lot of really vulnerable people are drawn to him because of what he preaches, because he says that he can help people transform their lives. And so the women told us that it was very difficult for them when they were allegedly treated this way.
So Tony Robbins has come out pretty forcefully and via his attorneys. They're responding pretty aggressively. We, by the way, have their full response to the fact that we were planning on interviewing you. They sent us a long letter, and we have that on our website. But they have come out pretty forcefully against you and BuzzFeed. They're suing the publication, correct?
All I can say is that BuzzFeed intends to vigorously defend against any litigation. He says that he's going to sue us in Ireland, and BuzzFeed fully stands behind this reporting, and you'll have to ask Mr. Robbins why he's choosing to sue us in Ireland instead of addressing the allegations in our reporting.
Can you talk just in general about how you began reporting on this story and why it's taken you the better part of a year and a half to do all this research and do all the reporting. It seems like a very complicated story. Oh. It's difficult to gain access, right, to his seminars unless you pay.
Yeah, well, I worked on this with a colleague. I also work on other stories, so it's not that I've only worked on this for a year and a half. But my colleague Jane, has been at his seminars, and once we published our first series, we received over 100 calls and emails. Three different people told us about Supercamp. They told us about this allegation, and they said, please look into this. And we obtained an alumni list from that summer, and we started talking to people. And I've never reported on a story where so many people said, as soon as I called and said I was a journalist calling about Supercamp, they said, you're calling about Tony Robbins, aren't you? So many people wanted to talk to us about what they remembered from that summer.
This is the allegation of that he sexually assaulted a young underage camper.
Yes.
I guess big picture, do you think that there has been any fallout from this on the part of his organization for Tony Robbins or for his followers? Are followers now starting to question his methods, do you think?
I don't know. You'd have to ask his followers. What I'll say is I think for a really long time, there's only been one perspective on the Tony Robbins universe, and it's been a very positive one. And what we found when we did our over 100 interviews is that there were people who had negative experiences with Tony Robbins, both by working for him and going to his seminars. And I think that those people deserve to also share their experiences along with the people who have had positive ones.
Katie Baker from BuzzFeed News. She's written a series of articles with a colleague on Tony Robbins. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like to read the full letter Tony Robbins' attorneys sent to us in response to our request for a statement from them, a PDF will be up later today at kcrw.com/pressplay. Coming up, a good news environmental story, how McDonald's and Ford are teaming up to turn coffee debris into plastic car parts. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We have cars that run on food like French fry oil, corn, even chocolate. So why not start making cars out of food too? Well, that's what Ford wants to do. Ford has partnered with McDonald's to use coffee bean waste to create plastic car parts. And because the cars would be lighter with these plastic car parts, they could emit less carbon dioxide. Transportation reporter Andrew Hawkins wrote about this for The Verge. Hi there.
Hello.
Well, what does this mean, coffee waste?
Yeah, so coffee chaff apparently is the name for the papery skin that comes off of a coffee bean during the roasting process. I've heard it described as something similar to like the skin that you'll find on like a peanut, for instance, uh-huh. that you kind of have to peel off. So I guess there's a lot of that stuff that gets generated, especially by a company like McDonald's that obviously is brewing lots of coffee for its thousands of restaurants around the world. And now they have this deal with Ford to put some of that that waste to a better use instead of putting it into a landfill.
Well, so how does it work? How do you turn this coffee chaff into plastic?
So apparently they heat it up and it turns into in sort of they heat it up in like a low oxygen environment where it's less likely to burn. And they mix that with some other forms of plastic and it forms these sort of micro pellets. And then these pellets can be used to sort of mold into car parts. And the car part that Ford really kind of highlighted as sort of being sort of the centerpiece for all this is a housing unit for its headlights on its cars. There's a plastic part behind the headlight that sort of holds the headlight in place. And this is a kind of one of those parts that they can make using these micro pellets that's produced from this coffee chaff.
Hmm. Okay, so it's starting small, let's be honest. It's not the whole truck bed, for example.
Correct.
But could it be eventually, could it be the entire car made out of this stuff?
I don't think so. I don't want to say definitively, but I mean, there's just a lot that goes into a car. A lot of it is metal, obviously. It's aluminum. It needs to be strong and it needs to withstand a lot of usage. So you'll get a number of years out of your car ownership. And plastic obviously takes a little bit more of a beating than metal does. Mm-hmm. So while there are a lot of plastic parts in a car, I don't think that this is necessarily something that we could see used to produce an entire vehicle. That said, I do think that you know, given how this partnership eventually goes on and, you know, sort of what sort of outcomes that Ford gets out of it and how happy they are with it, they see a lot of cost savings. If they see a lot of weight savings, you know, they said that these are parts that can end up being upwards of 20% lighter weight than the traditional forms of plastic that they use. That kind of weight saving is really important in the auto industry because it means fuel savings. If a lighter car ends up consuming less gas, mm-hmm. so that is another net positive in terms of environmental benefits. So
okay, but a net negative when it comes to Ford, in terms of the environment at least, would be their best-selling vehicle of all car manufacturers, and that's the F-150, that big truck.
Absolutely. Ford sold something like 900,000 F-150s last year. They just do crazy numbers with this car. It's their most popular car. It's the most popular vehicle in the United States. And this is a vehicle that consumes lots of polluting gas. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really interesting. You know, Ford just recently put out its first electric vehicle, the Mustang Mach-E. They said they're going to start producing that car, but they also said that their next electric car is going to be an electric Ford F-150. So clearly they see some advantage to electrifying the F-150, but that's not what we have right now. Right now, all the F-150s, all 900,000 of those that were sold last year are spitting out a lot of carbon into our environment right now.
Well, would they have these coffee car parts in them, the F-150s?
So Ford hasn't said exactly which vehicles these parts are going to be going into. It stands to reason that they're going to start somewhat limited and just sort of see how it goes. This is a pilot project. It's not something that they're really kind of going to be scaling out to their entire manufacturing operation quite yet. So they're going to probably test it out in a few vehicles. Whether or not it ends up in the F-150, they haven't said yet.
Well, meanwhile, Ford is going to adhere to California's emission standards, right, in direct contradiction to the Trump administration?
Yeah, that's correct. They announced just recently that they would be joining with a couple of other automakers to adhere to the less polluting fuel standards that exist in California. Obviously, this is a huge fight right now between California and the Trump administration. The White House wants to relax those standards, which in effect would make it easier for car manufacturers to build more polluting cars. And so Ford has sort of staked out its position, said, we're going with California. Meanwhile, you've got other automakers like GM and some other ones that have said, we need a federal standard. That's why we're going to stick with whatever the Trump administration comes out with. And there's going to be some litigation. So we're going to see exactly what happens with that and whether or not California gets to keep the powers that it has under the Clean Air Act to set its own fuel standards.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned that Ford is looking at creating an electric F-150. And of course, Tesla has unveiled, to a little bit of derision, I might add, its electric truck recently at the LA Auto Show.
Just a little bit, right?
Just a little bit. But I'm wondering if Ford sees its main competition down the line more a Tesla than a GM.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone at Ford watched that unveiling the other week from Elon Musk and Tesla and got too nervous about it. I mean, there's a lot of things that you could say about that Cybertruck. You know, Ford, I'm sure, sees the writing on the wall in terms of electrification, but the Ford F-150 outsells everything that Tesla does, the entire lineup. So it doesn't even really come close in terms of competition.
Andrew Hawkins is transportation reporter at The Verge. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Okay, that'll do it for us today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.